From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, does the United States need its public universities anymore?
Later, our foreign policy contributor says he's hopeful the Olympics might cause a prolonged thaw between North Korea and the rest of the world.
Sports, along with culture, are neutral and a way to try to develop new friends and new associations.
A GM designer talks about the all-electric Bolt and the effort to appeal to both electric vehicle fans and people who are new to the idea.
And novelist Cynthia Swanson explains her new novel is a thriller, but a character-driven one.
I love that, being on the edge of your seat and having that suspense in a story. But I also really want that to be driven by who the people are. I want to know about their motivations. It's not a whodunit, it's a whydunit.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. College is expensive. It's elitist. Enrollments are shrinking along with state budgets for higher education. These are just a few of the arguments against college these days. Added together, they beg the question, does the U.S. need public universities?
Christopher Newfield would probably answer that question with a qualified yes. Newfield teaches American Studies and Literature in the English department at UC Santa Barbara. Despite teaching fiction for the past 25 years, Newfield's main area of research has been in higher education policy.
He spent a lot of time planning and budgeting within the Academic Senate on his campus, which is partly the empirical basis of his new book, The Great Mistake: How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them.
He'll give the Dean's Distinguished Lecture in the Humanities at UW-Milwaukee this afternoon. Ahead of his visit, Newfield spoke about his book with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello. He described his ideas about the crisis of public universities, which he says he thinks we can fix.
The mistake was taking this great democratic institution, which was free college of a high quality, and making it expensive and unequal and elitist. So the accessible parts of the system, you know, community colleges, stayed relatively affordable, but they got worse in terms of quality. And then the great parts of the system became increasingly inaccessible, you know, flagships, Milwaukee, Madison, and so on. So the book is about the steps in that process of kind of devolution of our previous understanding of how you have great things that most people can enjoy, you know, how you can have high quality in a democratic way, small d. And then the end of the book is about how we can reverse these mistakes and fix the whole thing for not very much money.
You said a word there that I hear a lot in covering both K-12 and higher education, and that's high quality. I hear that word all the time, but everyone seems to have a different definition of what high quality is. So what's your definition of high quality education in the higher ed world?
Well, for me, it's kind of two stages. One is what's sometimes called mastery learning. And all that means is that everybody in the class learns all the material. In other words, it's not just a few people that get A's that do really well and master the subject. It's the whole class. And so, again, that's a democratic ideal as far as I'm concerned. You don't just bring a bunch of people in and then you have a system in which only a few succeed. Everybody succeeds. You know, that's the basic idea. And then the second phase is sort of creativity learning, or I think of what develops creative capabilities. And that for me is preparing students for, you know, the society of today and tomorrow, right? So it means having complex cognitive skills where you can deal with ambiguous information, lots of gray areas, incomplete information or uncertain information. So, you know, my worry is that we solved the quantity problem, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago by making it free and then using taxpayer funding, which is more efficient for getting everybody in regardless of their ability to pay. It's a very efficient system to use taxes. But we didn't solve the quality problem, partly because we thought we could just use kind of standardizing models in university in the same way that we were trying to do, you know, in K through 12. And that worked when we were mostly just preparing people for office work, for a lot of routine white collar production. So for me, quality or high quality means preparing people for non-routine cognitive activities, you know, where they have to define problems, they have to figure out the steps that they have to go through, they have to change their definition of the problem as they learn new things. I mean, these are kind of the high income areas as well as the big political challenge areas of the future and also of the present. And if we don't prepare the whole society, you know, the full spectrum of people to do that, and if we continue to try to run our society on the basis of people who went to Ivy League schools and their ideas and skills, we're gonna plateau at best or decline at worst.
So forgive me if I'm going down the wrong track here, but I wonder then, do you think having these really broad majors is a system that works or should be replaced? I'm thinking of the fact that most freshmen in major programs, I'm thinking of the fact that freshmen usually start in a 101 class and then they move on to 102 in their second semester, second quarter. When you're a sophomore, you go on to 201 and 202. What do you think of that sequencing or that same trajectory that we set students on as freshmen?
I don't think the 101, 102 sequencing is bad. I think the unorganized elective system is bad, where students make a lot of unguided choices about the other courses to take, and they have a hard time connecting the material and getting it to add up to, you know, kind of a coherent body of knowledge that they can then develop and use when they go out and work or go on to more school. So it's what we've done is we have a narrow bottom of the pyramid and then a really big top of the pyramid. And I think it needs to be reversed, that we have more sequencing so that students can see where they're going, where they've been, knowledge can accumulate more easily. And at the end of it, students can say to themselves, their friends, their parents, their future employers, everybody, what they've learned, you know, how it fits together.
So you're coming to Milwaukee to speak at UWM. And like most UW system schools, UWM has had a shrinking enrollment for a number of years. Our budget has also been shrinking. What do you hope people at UWM take from what you have to say about the public university system, given the circumstances of our state and our university system here?
Well, just on that enrollment issue, I think we should try to get a higher percentage of young people and also more older people into university. If your 18 to 25 population is shrinking or they're leaving the state or whatever it is, you know, it's not just Wisconsin by any means where this is happening. You need a higher percentage of that group to come. And then that involves some really interesting redesign practices for how to get students that might not go to come, and what kind of learning do they need to do, and how do courses need to change, and what kind of majors or new combinations of majors might make college seem more useful to non-goers. So that, I think, is part of it. The second thing is I think that, you know, it's not just where we need to rebuild our customer base. It's more we need to solve the challenges of Wisconsin and every state, broader understanding and broader capabilities in the people that are in the state so that it's justified in terms of the public good that universities provide of having a better educated population that can make better choices, can understand complicated problems, can come up with new ideas for, you know, businesses, but also new ideas for how to organize democratic processes, how to improve race relations, how to deal with opiate addiction. You know, there's a whole series of terrible but also fascinating social challenges, and we need a wider spectrum of the minds of all of our communities to be trained into high-level thinking about those problems.
So specific to Wisconsin, the state announced within the last year that the tech manufacturing giant Foxconn is going to build its American headquarters here, actually only about 40 minutes from UW-Milwaukee. And a lot of the system heads and individual school leaders have expressed desire to train students for those jobs, you know, providing in-state workers for this company that's going to be located within the state. Do you think putting an emphasis on training for those manufacturing jobs could impact the changes or progress that our system can make in terms of changing the way higher ed looks?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's sort of two things involved with that. One is that if it's traditional manufacturing, then it's more of a community college development opportunity. If it's advanced manufacturing that requires a lot of problem solving on the job, where you're basically you're running automated equipment, you know, there's teams that make production decisions, that kind of thing, then you need universities to teach these creative skills that will allow employees, you know, workers to participate fully in solving those kind of manufacturing problems. So, I mean, I think four-year universities have a role to play in not only Foxconn specifically, but in making Wisconsin seem like it's the kind of place that can provide the creative workforce that can, you know, really add value to those kinds of companies.
You've worked in a big system in California. We're smaller here in Wisconsin, but we're still a pretty big state university system. And we're actually now starting this process of consolidating. We're taking our two-year colleges and folding them into the four-year institutions. UW-Milwaukee, where you're coming to visit, is one of them. Milwaukee is going to become sort of the hub for this super campus that will absorb and include two two-year schools, UW-Waukesha and UW-Washington County. It's a pretty quick process. When it's all said and done, I think it'll be a little less than a year of work on this transition. Do you have any advice of things people can keep in mind, whether they are system leaders or department heads within the individual schools? Advice about how to make the transition work best for students in order to accomplish what you're saying is the goal of public universities, making them work for all students.
One thing is to not be too distracted by the reorganization and just stay focused on the education. So I'm a pessimist about reorganization, in that I think they usually don't achieve that much, but there's just enormous brain power and effort that goes into them. Meanwhile, what's actually happening in the classroom, in the laboratory, in the library can get neglected, and people aren't giving their best thought to, well, how can I improve learning here? How can I redesign, you know, this curriculum? I mean, that's the stuff that really counts. It's not the bureaucratic organization. And, you know, the University of California experiments with, you know, shared services where you move staff out of departments that do similar functions and put them all together somewhere else out of the department. Those kind of things have achieved absolutely nothing. So I really hope that that kind of stuff is not the focus. You know, those kinds of organizational efficiencies that sometimes pay off in the long run, but much less than you normally think. The real issue is, what are the public needs of the state? What kind of people need to come out of higher education? What are the social, intellectual, cultural, business, technical problems? And then how do we interface with those in a broad way, not a narrow vocational way, so that we can turn out, you know, the proverbial well-rounded person in large numbers to, you know, invent better solutions to problems than, you know, just consolidating campuses, for example.
Christopher Newfield teaches American Studies and Literature in the English Department at UC Santa Barbara. He spoke with Rachel Morello. Newfield's book is called The Great Mistake: How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. And he'll give the Dean's Distinguished Lecture in the Humanities today at UWM. There's more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break, and then our foreign policy contributor looks at what could be the long-term impact of Korean cooperation at the Winter Olympics. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Korea is on the minds of many around the world this month, but for the first time in a while, it's not the threat of war between the North and the South that dominates our minds. In fact, North Korea and South Korea's relationship is experiencing a rare thaw as the Winter Olympics play out in Pyeongchang, South Korea.
The opening ceremonies last week featured teams from both countries marching into the stadium under a unified Korean flag, and the women's hockey team playing in the Winter Games features players from both the North and the South. Our foreign policy contributor, Art Sear, has spent plenty of time in South Korea, and he's with us in the studio now. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to see you, sir. Thank you, as always, for having me on your program.
What is it about the Olympics and apparently women's hockey and some other sports that kind of enables this thaw in this longstanding frozen relationship?
Sports, along with culture, are neutral, and a way to try to develop new friends and new associations. In the 1930s, Nazi Germany was extremely aggressive in trying to have the Olympics in Germany and in Berlin, and they succeeded. It did not make a lot of new friends for the regime, but they did well enough that I think it's fair to say some credit accrued. This is several years before the beginning of World War II in Europe. On a more positive note, and certainly a more wholesome note, the U.S., from the beginning of the Cold War, has given some sustained emphasis not only to athletic but cultural educational exchanges. It's extremely, extremely important and also confirmed as, on balance, a positive way to get beyond national differences.
Sports also has this great propaganda value as well. I know
Hitler
knew that.
Exactly. Yeah, quite right. Took the words right out of my mouth. And, yeah, he was looking for propaganda, and that's the word that I was searching for. It sums it up. And we are, too. During the Cold War, there was intense competition, and not only during the Cold War, but since. The Soviet Union and now Russia have been not only accused but, in effect, convicted of doping their athletes. We did extremely well in the Olympics when rules were much more strict concerning amateur status, and the U.S., nonetheless, playing by the rules, did extremely well.
But in getting back to Korea then,
right.
is it that the propaganda value of cooperation at this point is stronger than the propaganda value of victory, if you will? Or did the North Koreans just see, you know, more to gain from being part of the world community in this way?
Yeah, I think it's an encouraging sign. They're much more calculating than they seem. Since the beginning of the Cold War, that regime has been addicted to hysterical, over-the-top, crazy broadcasts, including by loudspeakers directed toward South Korean and American and other UN troops during the war, and also since the war. I've been at the DMZ several times since 1985. The still very tense border separating North and South Korea at the 38th parallel, and there are always loudspeakers going on, very monotonous and tiresome. But that's part of the tone and substance of the regime. The North is much more calculating than they seem, and their survival eventually, and they know this, depends on, if not jump-starting, doing something to get their moribund economy off life support from China and, to some extent, Russia, and it's very much in their interest. They must be feeling more secure now, and ultimately that's to the good. That's to our benefit.
The opening ceremonies last week marked the first time a member of the ruling North Korean family set foot, to our knowledge, in South Korea, I think since the end of the Korean War. Would you imagine that there was other business that was done besides just that appearance in the stadium?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, they've been open about high-level conversations between a delegation from North Korea and South Korea. The leader in North Korea has invited the president of South Korea to have discussions. Let me take the opportunity to mention that I think this characteristic concern in Washington that there somehow might be a break or lack of solidarity between Washington and Seoul is quite misguided. It's their country, it's their peninsula, and the more the South Koreans, including their current very, very impressive president, can take the lead, I think, the better.
I wondered if there was something to be said for the U.S. not being necessarily a lead player in this way.
Yes, indeed. There's a lot to be said. And way back in the days of Richard Nixon, which I remember clearly, but not all of our listeners do, including you, sir.
I remember. I have some memory of the Nixon administration.
Well, he and Henry Kissinger from the get-go, from the start of the administration, started issuing a modestly titled State of the World report, which, as usual with Nixon and Kissinger, was serious, specific, and actually made a lot of policy sense. And from around 1970, President Nixon and his advisors were underscoring the fact that the U.S. can't and shouldn't do everything. We should be relying more and more on our allies. And that was during the height of the Cold War.
So we've seen situations both in Korea and other parts of the world in which some other factor, something like sports, has moved the needle in terms of international relations. Is there a window of opportunity these things create that needs to be taken advantage of?
Not immediately, necessarily. One of the strengths that so many of our Asian friends have, and we impatient Americans often do not, is taking the long view. It's extremely important. In conflict situations, I wish we'd been more mindful of that during the Vietnam War, and actually thought that at the time in my youth, not just with 20/20 hindsight. And patience and planning for the long term is particularly important, I think, at any time in foreign policy, but particularly in dealing with Asian developments, because by nature, our Asian friends seem to take a very long-term perspective.
It is remarkable to think about the women's hockey team representing Korea at this Winter Olympics. It consists not only of South Korean and North Korean women, but a handful of American and other North American players of Korean descent. It's kind of amazing to think of all of these nationalities competing under one flag.
Yes, very good point, very well put. I wish I'd said that. You're absolutely right. The Korean population has assimilated very, very effectively and successfully in the U.S. over a relatively short period of time, in contrast to some other populations, including from Asia, and our leaders in academia and lots of other areas. That's a basic asset of ours, and one reason, especially concerning women's collaboration, as usual, it facilitates that kind of cooperation across national borders. You're very, very right to bring up that point.
I do want to ask you about one other issue that's cropped up. In the midst of all this comes the news that President Trump is planning a major military parade along the lines of something we might see in North Korea or think back on from Soviet days. What do you make of that plan? Do these kinds of things, whether they're here in other countries, have any kind of sway in terms of how countries perceive each other?
We have actually a tradition in this country outside of parades concluding wars, particularly important in at the end of World War II in 1945 and the end of our Civil War in 1865. That's appropriate and a way of recognizing and reintegrating returning warriors and returning veterans.
But in terms of a parade demonstrating presumably military strength?
Yeah, that's not a tradition in this country, and I think it's most unfortunate, frankly. I have a link to, speaking of presidents and veterans, I have a link on my Carthage Clausen Center blog to Eisenhower's farewell address. I show it in class and to others as much as possible. It's extremely instructive. President Eisenhower, a credible and very successful military leader, He gave a series of observations and warnings about the importance and also danger of our military establishment. Among other things, he said, we don't have a military tradition in this country. A very large standing military is new. Since the beginning of the Cold War, we demobilized dramatically after World War II, but even before Korea, we're starting to remobilize. It's new, it's unavoidable, it's a serious threat to us. And he speaks quite eloquently about the cost is significant in terms of the military. I certainly mean no disrespect, quite the contrary, but military spending is sunk capital. It's not the same as productive capital. It's not the same as serving the population in humane ways.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He is a regular Lake Effect contributor.
First the EV1, then the Volt, now the Bolt. We'll talk about GM's forays into the electric vehicle market when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Time.
And I'm Bonnie North. General Motors' entry into the zero-emissions vehicle landscape started more than 20 years ago with its EV1 project. The effort was, by most accounts, successful. But the vehicles were all leased, and when the leases ran out, they were all returned to Chevrolet and unceremoniously destroyed.
More recently, though, Chevrolet has gotten more positive publicity with its latest low-emissions vehicles, the Volt, the Spark Electric, and now the zero-emissions Bolt with a B. 2017 was the first consumer model year for the Bolt, and it has attracted attention in dealerships and the Chicago Auto Show, where Lake Effect Automotive contributor Dan Harmon caught up with Todd Bruder, the lead development engineer for Chevy's Bolt project.
Bruder explained that while the technology has evolved since the EV1 days, the company's current efforts build on that earlier work.
Having the people around that have gone through some of the earlier phases of electrification has been helpful.
What I find particularly notable, if not impressive, is that most EV cars right now are in that 80-ish mile range, where the Bolt almost quadruples that. So I'm very curious as to why Chevrolet is able to do that, and or has made the commitment to do it, mm-hmm. where other companies that have had electric cars out there longer have not done that.
Yeah. So early on in the Bolt, we had looked at and spoke to a number of current EV owners and then EV intenders, people that wanted to get into an EV, and tried to understand what was it that was keeping them from getting into an EV vehicle, and what would they look for, and what would push them over the edge to buy an EV vehicle. And, you know, those things, it boiled down to essentially, usability of the vehicle as far as interior space and efficiency of space. Price, they wanted below $30,000. They wanted range. We found that the most of the EV intenders, that if you got above 200 miles range, that would push them over. That would start to get them to think hard about an electric vehicle. And then performance, they wanted it to be able to drive it like a normal vehicle, have decent pickup, and be able to drive highway speeds and such. So those areas are what we focused on from the get-go with the Bolt EV. And so all of that hinged around the what size pack we wanted to use, battery pack we wanted to use, how we wanted to integrate it into the vehicle, and then pushing the limits or pushing the energy of the cells themselves to try to get there. We had a goal of a minimum of 200 miles when we started this. That was the range we knew would start to get people interested in moving from a non-EV vehicle into an EV vehicle. So as we built the started designing the vehicle, right, we went with a 60 kilowatt hour pack, which is a fairly large pack compared to some of the EV vehicles that were out there at the time, and keeping it below that that entry point of $30,000. We took that pack and integrated it into the lower structure of the body. By making it part of the floor pan, it did a couple things, right? It improved that interior space. That was one of the things they wanted the vehicle to be usable, right? So we had lots of good interior space in the vehicle by making the pack part of the floor pan. It became part of the structure. And so we were able to design the body itself with, combinations of aluminum and high-strength steels, and then the pack as part of the structure itself. We were able to have a body in white that also allowed for, large openings and low step-over heights for efficiency into the vehicle, but also we had to manage the mass of the vehicle to get that range. That range is not just battery itself, right? You have to concentrate on the aerodynamics, the rolling resistance of the tires, the mass. A lot of the other say non-traditional EV parts of the vehicle, you have to concentrate on those as well in order to get that target range. So you have to start with a good energy source, so that 60 kilowatt hour pack, have an efficient motor, and then design the vehicle to optimize that and to be able to get over that 200 mile range. And we got that 238, which we were all ecstatic about. We blew our target out of the water as far as that's concerned.
And this is not Chevrolet's only car that has some form of electrification, if you will. The Volt certainly does, and where I live, there's the Spark EV. Thank you. So I'm wondering, maybe this is a little more esoteric question, but is it easier, and I'm air quoting easier here, to design an electric car from scratch rather than going like the Spark EV, just turning that into an electric car? Because as you mentioned, there are other factors involved.
I don't know if it's easier. Some aspects are probably easier because you get to start with a clean slate. Others, maybe not so much because you do have to do everything from the ground up. By starting with a clean slate, which we knew, early on decided that that's what we needed to do in order to, meet these, that four criteria that we felt that was going to excite the customers and get the customers pushed over the edge. You know, starting with that clean slate, it allowed us to get that. So if we had used an existing architecture, some of those things would have been difficult to reach. We may have been limited on what we could have gotten with Aero. We may have been limited on where we could have gone with some of the mass improvements. So as far as the Bolt EV's success, a lot of it does hinge on starting with a clean slate.
And, I've driven quite a few electric cars. Some of them are, I'm interested in the differences in the way the interface with the driver happens. Like if it's the Golf electric, it's very simple. There's nothing about it, except for a few visual styling cues on the exterior that let you know that it's an electric car. So Volkswagen made the decision to just keep it, essentially just convert a car that's already existed. And then other cars are a little more, I'll use the word dazzling, if you will, because they want you to know it's electric. So I'm wondering what kind of either conversations or planning was involved in the Bolt's interface, the way that it presents itself, and the way that the technology interacts with the driver.
Yeah, the Bolt EV, if you look at it, in my opinion, it sort of straddles that, right? It has features that it can excite an electric vehicle enthusiast, but also it's not so niche to scare away someone new to a electric vehicle, and that was purposeful. We did a lot of things, even with the way the vehicle drives, to make it drive and feel as comfortable as possible to someone who's new to the electric vehicle space, but also have features in there that would excite an electric vehicle enthusiast. In particular, I want to talk about the selections we have for drive modes. We have a normal drive mode, which is what we call D or drive, and with our electronic range selector. And the way we calibrated that is for it to drive like a conventional vehicle. So when you lift your foot off the accelerator pedal, the vehicle will coast like a traditional vehicle. We do capture energy back into the battery when you're coasting in drive. But if you're in that mode, someone new to the EV space coming from a conventional vehicle would find that the vehicle's not that different. And, maybe try to alleviate some of the apprehension they may have had in getting into an electric vehicle. But yet we have our one pedal driving, which is something that I think is a great feature of this vehicle, and our engineers that designed that did a great job. The one pedal driving, if you move the selector into low, you can now drive, we increase our regen, and you can drive just using the accelerator pedal and just modulating your speed with the accelerator pedal, and you don't need to go over and put your foot on the brake unless there's an emergency situation. But you can drive around town all day with just modulating your speed with the accelerator pedal, recapturing all that energy as you come to a stop. And it'll hold the vehicle. It'll cancel creep torque, so the vehicle will hold in place. With you take your foot off the accelerator pedal, it'll hold up to certain grades. So if you're in a city, stop and go traffic, or just driving to work on back roads, you'll find that the one pedal driving is really convenient and is truly fun to drive, and you know that you're recapturing as much of that energy as you can as you're driving. So, by providing both some features that an electric vehicle owner can get excited about, but yet not going so far, niche with electric vehicles, we make it a vehicle that a non-EV person, can get into and feel comfortable.
As the lead development engineer, I'm very curious as to what your parameters were when you came on board, because you're obviously very knowledgeable about electric cars. What is it that you determined was working in other cars and other models, and what was and wasn't? So what is it that you were able to then put into play with this car?
So when I came on, a lot of the area was around trying to, as I spoke about before, trying to normalize the car as much as we can, try to get the brakes to feel like a normal brakes, or brakes that would be that you would see on another vehicle, right? Getting that one pedal driving working properly, getting all that we can out of the vehicle to try to get the range that we were looking for. So, you know, there was a lot of, fine tuning. When I came on, a lot of the vehicle had already been sort of decided and designed. We took that and then pushed it over the finish line to try to get to the best we can in that range, in that space, in the driving feel. My area in particular, as lead development engineer, is a lot of the performance integration. So it's what the customer feels and touches, right? So how does it ride? How does it steer? How does it brake? What range are we getting? What are the charging features like? What is the interface like on the radio? Those types of touchy-feely things kind of fall in my area. So what I was tasked with and was responsible for was to really take this, electric vehicle and make it something that a conventional customer would recognize and be comfortable with.
And was there a discussion at any point about whether or not to have as BMW calls it, a backup generator with the car, or you thought the mileage was maybe sufficient enough that was not even something worth discussing?
We offer two vehicles. We have the Volt, which has our EREV system in it, right, which has the engine and battery and electric motor, right? So the Bolt EV was never intended to be like the Volt. We already have a vehicle that has the a range extending engine in it. The Bolt EV was from the beginning primarily, or was going to be exclusively an electric vehicle. Yep.
Well, now that it's been out and it's out to the public, what are your thoughts on it, and what are some changes you want to, or maybe advancements you want to make?
So the thoughts on it, right, is it's the greatest car I've ever worked on. It's the most exciting car I've ever worked on. It's the most fun to drive. So as far as my thoughts on the car, it's the best. As far as future changes, improvements, I can't talk about what we have planned for the future. We're a year and a half into selling the vehicle, so we'll see what comes in the next couple of years with it.
Well, Todd Bruder, thank you very much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
Todd Bruder is lead development engineer for the Chevrolet Bolt. He spoke with automotive contributor Dan Harmon at the Chicago Auto Show.
We will take one last break and then have a conversation with novelist and Wisconsin native Cynthia Swanson about her newest book, The Glass Forest. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We first talked with writer Cynthia Swanson a few years ago when her debut novel, The Bookseller, was published. It went on to become an award-winning New York Times bestseller. The book took place in the Denver of the early 1960s, a time in history Swanson finds fascinating.
So it's no surprise that her latest book, The Glass Forest, is also set in that era, although its settings are New York and in Door County, Wisconsin. The book is just out, and Swanson will be at Boswell Book Company on Thursday, but she joins us ahead of time by Skype and explains why this era captures her imagination.
You know, I think a lot of it is just the social fabric was so interesting, and all of the changes that were going on. There was just enormous social changes going on all over the country, for women especially. Women's lives were changing so much. And I find that fascinating, and especially now where you look at kind of the social climate that we have going on in our times. And I feel like we're going through a lot of changes now, too. And so there's some kind of, there's some parallels, and there's some places where we can learn from history what we want to do differently and the mistakes that we don't want to repeat.
And you've embodied these changes in a couple of really interesting characters. There's the younger character of Angie, and then there's also, I won't even call her middle-aged because she's not even quite that old, but the character of Celia, who is somewhat of an anomaly in this time frame. She's a working woman.
Right, and a businesswoman, and, you know, very prosperous. So not just working outside the home, but really supporting her family.
And wanting to. I mean, it's partially, it's driven by some things that are happening in her home, but also it's part of who she wants to be.
Absolutely, yeah. She's 38 years old at the time of the story, so not middle-aged quite. But at that time, having gone through her life, went to college and began a career because of circumstances with her family, and her husband ends up raising their daughter. So it's just, it's a very, very different kind of family situation than a lot of people have. But it ends up, yeah, evolving into really what she wants in a lot of ways as far as her lifestyle. I think as she, when she's younger, it's a quandary for her. She feels like she wants to be home and raise babies, and it just doesn't turn out that way. But then she finds some power in who she becomes.
Yeah, I really liked her. And there was this interesting kind of, she's Finnish by heritage. And so there's, you bring in a lot of that expatriate community in New York. This happens to be in Brooklyn at the time. And the kinds of things she was both raised in, but also leaving behind.
Yeah, it was really interesting researching that Finnish heritage for her. I really kind of came across it by accident. I needed her to be from Brooklyn. I needed her to be a second generation American and have some ethnicity, but I didn't want her to be, for reasons of the story, I didn't want her to be Jewish and I didn't want her to be Catholic. And that turned out to actually be a really tall order to find a good heritage for her. But I sort of discovered these Finnish socialists in Brooklyn, and it was just this small pocket community of people, but it was very, very active in the socialist movement in the early part of the 20th century, and it worked perfectly for her character and for the character of her mother and for how her family structure came together and who she became. So it was just one of those pieces that really fell into place nicely.
Well, it was so interesting to read because I knew nothing about them, you know, and I thought, wow. And it's one of those, as you say, these little pocket stories that there's all over the place, but you just don't know. And it added such a rich texture to the entire story, because one of the things, you know, mentioned the socialist background, one of the things that is in conflict here is that idea of capitalism versus communism and socialism. And
correct.
And it's both a background noise in the novel, but it's also almost a protagonist, too.
Yeah, it's very present for all of the characters in the way that their lives are structured and what goes on and how their lives change. Again, it comes back to that, why that 50s, 60s time period is so interesting to me, because there was so much of that kind of change going on. And people were threatened by certain ways that other people felt about lifestyles and how they wanted to live and what they wanted the country to look like. Some people felt very threatened by that, and I found that very interesting as well.
Well, of course, you know, Wisconsin being the home of McCarthy and the witch hunts and all of that sort of stuff, which by the time this book has taken place, they are more or less over.
Right.
But we're, you know, the country is still living with that legacy. And of course, one of the protagonists of the book is from Wisconsin and Door County.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah. Angie is 21 years old and she is from Bailey's Harbor, born and raised there. I got asked this by my Wisconsin family, you know, why did you pick Door County and Bailey's Harbor for her hometown? And we have family friends who have a place on North Bay. So we've spent a lot of time there, my family and I have. And I needed her to be not just from a small town, but I really wanted her to be from somewhere really idyllic. So it had to be a Wisconsin place that had a strong sense of place that people in the Midwest would recognize. Oh, Door County, who doesn't love Door County? And feel like, okay, she got to go and leave and she thought she was having this great adventure, but really she spends most of the novel wanting to get back there. And really, who wouldn't, right?
Well, except when you're 21, you know, if even if you grew up in paradise, you want to leave it.
Sure. But she thought she did. She wanted to go see what the world looked like. She got to go to New York, and she thought that was pretty exciting at first. And then she realizes how much she misses home.
She grows up a lot in this book. And so even though she wants to go back and eventually does, I don't think we're giving anything away by saying that she does eventually head back, but she is forever changed.
And
brings that change with her, even though we don't know yet at the end of the book, we don't know how that might manifest in her life going forward.
I think with my books, I've realized something that with my themes all start with C-O-N. In The Bookseller, I feel like contentment was the theme. And in this book, I feel like confidence is the theme. And especially for Angie, that's something that she develops over time. She doesn't really have that when she starts out. And then as she goes through this experience, she really finds out who she is and grows a lot in her confidence in herself.
Well, and you talk about confidence, and another protagonist in the book is Ruby, who is a teenager when we meet her. And she's a niece, right? She's Angie's niece.
She's Angie's niece, yes.
Right. And she has a confidence that sort of belies her years.
Correct. Yes. She has a confidence that is like no one else that you will ever meet. She's a mystery, and she's supposed to be a mystery. It's intentional. Although we do hear narration through her viewpoint, there's always an underlying sense that Ruby's not even telling us everything as readers. Whereas Angie and Celia really pretty much lay it out for us over time. But with Ruby, we kind of feel like maybe she's holding back, and we only find out what Ruby wants to tell us. And that's that sort of innate confidence that she's always had. She just had it as intuition more than anything, I think.
We've talked about the three main female characters. We haven't talked about the male characters, and they are equally as important and drive the story in their own ways, but they are very different, and you've drawn them all very differently, starting with the two brothers, and then, of course, then there's Dr. Shepherd.
So the two brothers, it's Henry and Paul, and they are less than a year apart in age. They look almost exactly alike, but they're very different in demeanor. Paul is the younger brother, and he's charming, and he is a ladies' man, and he kind of knows how to sort of win the hearts of everybody around him. And that's Angie's husband, and he's 17 years older than Angie. So she meets him. He shows up out of nowhere in Door County and starts bartending at Gordon Lodge, and that's where they meet, and these painting on the side, and she just becomes captivated by him, and they get married and have a baby, and she feels like she's found her perfect match.
She's won the lotto. Yeah.
I mean, she got like the guy that no one else in her hometown got. So she just feels like this is it. I won. And then there's Henry, and Henry is married to Celia. They marry very young. They meet during World War II when he's on leave in New York City, and they have a whirlwind romance and get married, and then he ships out. And she's left, and she's pregnant with Ruby. And he comes back several years later from the war, and it's clear that he has suffered some trauma when he's there, although he won't talk about what happened. You know, these days he would be identified and diagnosed with PTSD, but back then that didn't happen very often for too many returning GIs. And so he really suffers mentally, and he closes down a lot. So he becomes somebody. Again, and maybe that's a little bit where Ruby gets that too, is from maybe that's the nurture part, is she watches him close down, and she knows that he just doesn't give away very many pieces of himself. And that's how he lives, and that's who he becomes.
Obviously, the book is a thriller and kind of a mystery, and we find out most things at the end. There's still a few little things left up in the air. Were you just trying to take us on a really interesting ride there, or was there something else that you want us to take away from this book?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's a thriller. And the way that I've heard it described by several people who've reviewed it so far is that it's a character-driven thriller. And I think that is important as a distinction, in that I feel like if we're going to have a thriller, I love that being on the edge of your seat and having that suspense in a story. But I also really want that to be driven by who the people are. I want to know about their motivations. It's not a whodunit, it's a whydunit. So it's not a mystery. It's not like, oh, you know, did the butler do it? It's well, what drove these people to end up where they did? How did we end up getting this to happen? And so those pieces unfold really slowly in kind of a slow burn situation. And that was intentional. I didn't want to write a book that followed all the formulas of a regular mystery. It has some of those elements, but I really wanted to explore the personalities and the characters of all of these different people that are involved in the story.
Did you know when you first started where it was going to end up, or did that kind of reveal itself to you as you went along?
I had a little bit of a sense, but because it's such a plot-driven story, I had to work really carefully to make sure all those pieces fell into place. And when I started writing it, I was writing it, it alternates or varies in chapter between Celia and Ruby and Angie. And I started writing it that way. And then I realized partway through that first draft that I really had to get Celia's story down, because Celia's the one who gives us the background and she's missing. So we're sort of getting these stories of the history from this missing woman as the story progresses. And I needed to know her whole story before I could tell the current story happening in 1960, which is we're getting through the viewpoint of Angie and Ruby. So I had to really pull together a lot of pieces. I learned a lot writing this book. It really stretched me as a writer. It's very different from The Bookseller. And the process of writing it was very, very different from writing The Bookseller.
Interesting that you say that from your perspective. From mine as a reader, yes, they are very different books. But there's also a voice through them that I recognize as yours. And I think it's that care of character, that care of why these people. Because I felt the same way in The Bookseller. I cared about what happened to these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
I wanted, it's not just like, oh, they were cogs in a wheel and everything kind of came out. I really wanted to know. And some things, you know, that happen in the glass forest, I think, oh, really? Darn it. or oh, really? Wow. That's really cool. You know,
right.
Because I wasn't really expecting that. And I had gotten invested in
right.
who these people were. And so I would say maybe that's what ties the books together, is that care, that authorial care.
Most definitely. And that goes back to wanting to write character-driven stories. And in a lot of ways, it was the same with The Bookseller, is that, you know, something happened and it's a woman caught between a dream life and a real life. Well, that's cool, but what's the why? Why would that happen to somebody? How could a person get in that situation? And that's what unfolds in The Bookseller, in the same way that this one is a thriller and we've got a mysteriously missing woman and a guy who's committed suicide and then a group of characters who have to deal with the fallout. Well, why? What happened? Why did he commit suicide? Why is she missing? Why did she run away? How did this all come together? And that all has to do with those characters and those personalities and making sure everybody is doing what would make sense for that particular character.
Wisconsin native Cynthia Swanson's latest book is called The Glass Forest. She'll talk about it in conversation with Bonnie North on Thursday evening at Boswell Book Company, and you'll find links to more information about the book and the event at WUWM.com. That's all for this edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It is 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.
Take me to heaven above and say you love me.